A new report launched today calls for a radical overhaul of ACC and a new integrated system to cover all impairments, whether from illness or accident. The ACC scheme was established in 1974 as a no-fault system that covers people who are injured in an accident and can't work or need rehabilitation. It does not cover people who are unwell or disabled. So, if you can't work because of an accident, you're covered by ACC. But if you can't work because of a cancer diagnosis, you're on your own. Warren Forster is a lawyer and researcher who's been working in the ACC sector for many years. He says the current system is discriminatory, arbitrary, and a negative experience for many. And New Zealand could and should have a single system that covers all impairments. A report that he's published today with the support of the Law Foundation is the culmination of 7 years of research, reflecting thousands of cases he's either been involved with or which have been shared with him by claimants. And Warren Forster is with us on Nine to Noon. Kia ora, good morning.
Morena, Susie and listeners. Nice to be here.
Thank you for your time today. ACC, of course, something that many people have interacted with one way or the other over the years. The current system, no fault, covers injuries from accidents, but it is pretty limited. What do you see as being the most significant limitations?
It's difficult to sort of nail it down to one or two things, Susie. But if we sort of look at what's happening in Parliament at the moment and compare it to what happened 50 years ago, it gives us a stark contrast. So 50 years ago, this month actually, Parliament was starting to debate the accident compensation legislation. And this was a big change. It was going to change the way things were done. And now we're debating the definition of accident. So one thing that's in Parliament at the moment is what defines an accident. And Parliament's looking at birth injury. And they're saying, oh, is this birth injury in or is this birth injury out? So it's a completely different scale of what we're looking at. And we're still tinkering and changing definitions. So that's the political level problem, is we're changing how we define things, not actually looking at the underlying problems. And if you step back and think about those underlying problems, there's massive discrimination that affect every family in New Zealand is affected by this. If you have cancer or mental distress, you don't get any help. But about 40% of our population lodges an ACC claim every year for a sore ankle or a work injury or something. So this cause and what's causing the need for you to receive help from society is such a driver of negative experiences. It's unbelievable.
So the current system then, is it effectively causing harm because of that way it operates?
Yes, it is. It is absolutely causing harm, but not so much by the way it operates. It is in the sense that we design a law and ACC is operating that law. But this is really a problem with the law that Parliament's making, Susie. This isn't ACC doing the right thing or the wrong thing. ACC does a lot of things right every day. They do hundreds of thousands of things right, but they do some things wrong. But all of those things are focusing on trying to put you in a box about what's causing your impairment. And if we take that away and we can focus on helping people, then we're going to remove all of that harm caused by the administration of boundaries. If Parliament makes laws, someone has to administer them. And the more complicated and difficult they are to administer, the more expensive they are to administer, and the harder it is for people to navigate that system. And we can build navigators and navigation systems, but we can also just say, actually, Taiho, let's stop back and look at what's actually happening here. And can we redesign that so it works better? It's a better experience for people. It's more effective. It's more efficient. And over time, we should drive the cost of that system down because it's actually working the way it's meant to.
This report that you've published today, in conjunction with the Law Foundation, certainly with the support of the Law Foundation, what sorts of stories did you hear from people, examples of situations that people are in because of the current setup with ACC?
Heartbreaking one, Susie. When I was working as a barrister representing people, it would upset me every day. And the same when I was doing this research, you're talking to people who just have their lives either on hold, waiting for things to happen, or they're stuck between two systems. There's some examples that I put in, and I had a survey when I first started this particular project, which was over 4 years ago now, where we had About 850 people responded to that survey with their experiences, and I distilled some of those down and put them in the report. But examples of people who are abused in care. So one of the Royal Commissions we have going on at the moment. So there's people who've experienced abuse, and then there's a whole lot of other layers that then happen on top of that. And when the person is trying to get help from ACC, they need to show that they're an earner when they're abused, and that it's not a drug and alcohol problem, it's the abuse. And all of this stuff just sucks you into a dispute. So the effect of that is about 1% of people who are abused in care, sorry, who have cover for sensitive claims with ACC, so about 1% of those covered for sensitive claims actually receive weekly compensation. Now, that is telling us that the system that we have isn't working because of all these boundaries and complexity that we build into it. So, that's just one example. We have other examples about people who need wheelchairs or prosthetic limbs. Those who have ACC cover get basically to turn up to the expo of what's new happening this year and say, well, what would make a difference in my life? Really positive, forward-looking. Those who don't have ACC cover need to literally fight with the health system, and now perhaps the new ministry, I don't think they've even decided who's going to administer aids and appliances. And if you want to go somewhere, you want to get out into your community, if you have ACC cover, you get support, you get transportation. If you don't, it's very, very difficult to be included in a community. And these are things that happen to all of us. They happen to our families, they happen to our parents, they happen to our children. But some people get what they need and others don't. And that's heartbreaking.
So a radical approach, it sounds like, is what you are advocating for in this space. What should happen? Is it an expansion of ACC and its remit? Is it a complete overhaul, sweeping away all of the current situation and starting again from scratch?
Well, this is a big question, Susie. I don't really mind what we call it, although I'm probably adverse to the idea of calling it an accident compensation system if it doesn't just cover accidents. I don't really want to spend the next 10 years changing the definition of accident to fit things in, which is what's happening at the moment in Parliament. So I'm saying we need to take a principle-based approach. The four things which I'm calling enforceable rights is social support, income support, habilitation, and healthcare for disabled people. They're the things, now in the ACC system, we call them entitlements. I think there's some problems with the word entitlement and all of the constructs that come with that. So I think calling them enforceable rights, which is what they are. And then I've set out six principles for expansion, and they say, how do we get from where we are now to this future state? And that talks about, bringing Te Tiriti and the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities to the forefront and actually designing the system so it meets those obligations. That's the first principle. The second is to have integration. So I don't have to turn up and go somewhere for my mental health support, somewhere else for my physical health support, and have a fight between the two of them who should be paying for X, Y, Z. So we need to have integration both within systems so that I can go to one place to get the health care that I need, and also between the health and the social and the income support. So there needs to be integration there. That's the second principle. The third one is progressively realize this so we can do it over time. We're not going to do it tomorrow. The fourth is that we need to innovate how we fund things. And then the next is to improve health and safety in communities and then provide the oversight. So I've got a principle-based approach and a roadmap about how we get from where we are now to the future state. And that's something which I'm saying, do we agree on this vision about what the future will be? We have an integrated person-directed system for people. If we agree on that vision and we agree on a principle-based approach, then we can work out as we go what we're going to do. But the end state will be, Susie, that in 5 or 10 years' time, whenever the system is built, we aren't going to have what we have now. But I don't think we're at the point now where we can make decisions on service delivery. Is ACC going to deliver it, or health, or whatever? I don't think we're at that point because we haven't decided what it's going to deliver. So I put a roadmap there about the series of decisions that we need to make to bring this to life. But if we can agree on the vision, we can start.
Now, how does this work in with something that people are perhaps aware of and have on their, on their radar a bit, which is this social income insurance scheme that the government is looking to bring in? It would seem, perhaps, on the face of it, that some of what is included there is beginning to touch on and overlap with some of these areas that you're speaking about.
Yes, Susie. When I first started talking to people about it 5 years ago, these were crazy ideas that no one thought would happen. At that point, I lived in Dunedin. I had hair and I had an idea that no one believed in. Now I've got no hair, live in Wellington, and I've got an idea that people are starting to believe in. So since that time in the last 5 years, the health system's been reformed. So we've got a single system there. That's critical because when you're trying to integrate services, you need to have a single system. We've had the Ministry for Disabled People launched. Now, again, that's a few weeks ago, just along with the health system. I had a choice about waiting to see what would happen with the income insurance system or to actually get it out. And that's basically what I've done here. There definitely will be some overlap. But when you look at that income insurance system, it's going to recreate a lot of the inequity that we see in the ACC system. It only works for people who are in work when they have their impairment. Now, about 40% of disabled people are in work. That's last year's data. We should get some more data now, compared to just under 80% of people who are non-disabled. So again, we've immediately excluded from income support a whole cohort of people. Those who lose their job because of labour market conditions or because of redundancy, they're off work for several months on average. And the data that the officials pulled together for that income insurance system is that more than half or around half disabled people are off work for 2 years and they're going to pay them income support for a few months. So it won't work. It's not integrated. We have no treatment tied into that the income insurance system. So again, there will be boundaries. It's not the worst thing in the world to support people. I'm okay with the idea, but let's be honest about how it will actually operate. When ACC looked at data from work accidents, I think 80% of the income support's paid to men. That's a massive discrimination within a system. And now the reason for that is that it was designed in a time when work accidents were physical, and people who have mental distress from work or other gradual process injuries are excluded. And we're going to recreate a lot of these boundaries if we just jump in and do the same thing as we've done before. And that's why I'm saying we really need to pause and think. And just jumping in on a system, I get why the government wants an income insurance system, because if we have another lockdown like COVID or something else, it can cope with it. And I don't dispute that. But it's going to have a massive discriminatory effect on disabled people. So let's pause and think about whether we want that or whether we want to actually integrate this stuff. And that's what I'm saying. At the point we're making these decisions on what income support will be provided, which I'm saying is year 2 to 4, we'll have an idea of what that income insurance system looks like and how it will work. But when I first spoke to officials about that, it was called a social insurance system, and it was going to do some of the things that I'm talking about. They've taken the social out of it. They've called it an income insurance and they've limited its scope. Now, that's what governments can do. I'm not the government. I don't get to make these decisions. But I'm challenging people in power and MPs to actually come and have a discussion, start working together and looking at a system that's going to work, not in this election, not in the next election, but for the next 10 elections. We need a system that can survive 3, 4, 5 changes of government, that's principle-based and forward-looking. That's what we need.
We must have a word, though, quickly on the cost of all of this, because the income insurance scheme there, which, as you say, is limited in a lot of ways, not just in the benefits that it puts forward, it was going to be funded, or is going to be funded, by levies on wages and salaries. So both workers and employers pay about 1.39% each. So, you know, a levy, a tax, you know, call it what you like, but that's going to cost, basically, is the bottom line. And how much would the cost be to the country of the sort of scheme that you are proposing? And is it the kind of cost, especially at this time when, you know, inflation is so high, cost of living's going up, that people would be able to wear?
Yeah, look, great question, Susie. And that's one that I've been asked the whole way through. And the answer is pretty clear. Until we determine policy settings and model it, we don't know. We're guessing. If you want me to guess, I will. The government a few years ago asked someone to put some calculations on the back of an envelope, and they could say it's $3 to $4 billion. I think that's probably the wrong way of looking at it. The way I look at it is this. People need something. If they need something, we're going to either pay for it by the state, pay for it individually, or they don't get it. Now, if we're going to actually look at reducing cost over time and taking a system approach, we need to know what that cost is, 100% agree to that, and we need to know how we're going to fund it. But at the moment, health and social inflation is growing at a higher rate than GDP growth. So that means that the extra tax the government gets every year is good, but it's not enough to cover that inflation gap. What I'm saying in the report is, if we take a view that what we're trying to do is to not cover the entire cost, but to cover the gap between health and social inflation and tax income growth, then we can use a sovereign wealth fund. And this is where the ACC funding model is actually fantastic. So in the last 9 years, the return on investment ACC's got is pretty similar to the total cost of the entitlements it's paid. So it's paid out $29 billion in entitlements, and it's got $32 billion in entitlements, $29 billion in return on investment, and it spent about $6 billion administering itself. Now, if we look at that, that's an incredible funding model. Singapore funds its entire health system using sovereign wealth fund models. So what I'm saying is, if we have a sustainable, we can't keep doing what we're doing with tax income, because unless tax grows at a much higher rate, or the economy grows at the same rate as health and social inflation, we're going to be in the same boat of not having enough money to pay for stuff, and we're going to have rationing. So what I'm saying is, let's have an actual conversation about how we're going to build a sustainable funding model. Yes, we need tax, agree. Yes, we need levies, yes. Mm. But let's not get ourselves in a position where we're spending billions administering boundaries and then fighting about who gets what in a rationing system. Let's say, here's what we're proposing, here's what it will cost, here's how we're going to fund it. And we can use that return on investment of the sovereign wealth fund model to cover that gap, which means that we can make plans, we can be honest about it, we can make intergenerational plans. This is the kind of conversations that we need to be having.